looks like we're going to have a quorum, so why don't we start off with taking roll.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean.
Here.
Representative Hertas. Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Here.
Representative Lohmer. Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Neuberger.
Ready, sir.
Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Rosenthal.
Here.
Representative Schoen. Representative Ward. Representative Winkler. And Representative Zerwas.
Okay, we bring the meeting to order and start out with somebody want to offer up the minutes for February 17th? Representative
I'll
Dean.
I'll move the minutes from previous meeting.
Okay, Representative Dean moves the minutes from February 17th. Any additions or corrections without that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Members, we have a bill up today, House File 71. Representative Dinsky has got the criminal vehicular homicide bill. And who wants to move the bill? Well, to move the bill for consideration and, believe, hold over for possible inclusion. And Representative Johnson will move House File... House File 71. And Representative Zerniski, did you have an author's amendment you we got to talk about?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we've got we actually got two amendments that I'd like to have. One is more technical in nature, and the second one is it talks about just expanding an area that we considered was in the bill, but we just after second look we didn't have it in there, and that's or resulting in bodily harm to the death or another, the A1 amendment.
Okay, and I wanted to ask Representative Hillstrom's okay on this. We to waive the A1 amendment. It came in late, and it doesn't look like it makes a substantive change. What do you think about that?
Mr. Chair, given that you're going to lay this over for possible inclusion, in the event anyone has any concerns, we have plenty of time to change it later, so I have no objection to...
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. So which amendment you want to move first, the A1?
Yes, the A1 amendment.
Okay, Representative Johnson moves the A1 amendment and get it in the shape the author wants it. Any objection? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the A1 amendment, and then the A15-0017 amendment. This looks kind of technical, mm-hmm. A lot of subdivisions. I probably won't have to explain that much, but all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, you can just go ahead however you want to with your bill.
Thank you very much. Chair Cornish, I appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill before you. I also want to thank Rebecca Pierce for her assistance in the construction of this bill from House Research. Drake's Law is being brought before you today because of the tragic events caused by a repeat drunk driver. Drake's Law increases the upper limit that an impaired driver may be sentenced to in the unique cases where a previous qualified prior offense occurred. Drake's Law would set a maximum statutory sentence from 10 up to 15 years. Qualified prior offense includes fourth-degree DWI involving damage to property, and with the amendment also with or resulting from bodily harm or death of another. So in a previous DWI, we could look back into those records that happened within the last 10 years and use that as a precursor for increasing the maximum statutory offense. This is obviously up to judicial review, so we're not setting mandatory minimums or maximums. We are just setting, looking at where we could potentially go when it comes to the sentencing guidelines for folks that are involved in these incidents. And then also any other sort of property damage that may occur. So, you know, the idea behind that in using qualified prior offenses is really the mindset of, because it's such a touchy portion of law, We're looking at the idea of where folks are have a prior offense where physical damage was done or physical injury occurred in a prior DWI. This would give the idea that, you know, individuals that were causing these accidents should really take that under account when something else happens. And, you know, I appreciate your consideration on this bill, and I appreciate your support. I do have Brad and Heather Bigler are here to testify before the committee today. They are the parents of Drake. And I can answer any questions, or we can go straight into some testimony or whatever you'd like to do. So
maybe the testifiers will take care of some of the questions. Or do you want to ask you a question now, or, Representative Considine?
If you don't mind, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
What about their driver's license? Do they get their driver's license back after that?
Representative Zudinsky.
After
killing somebody.
Well, I do believe that over time they potentially do. I don't believe they. I don't know. We'd have to talk to research as far as the permanent loss of a driver's license, if that's what Representative Constantine's question is. I do believe that there are modes to get those back, but I'm not sure of the exact list. Maybe House Research can answer that question better than I could.
Your bill doesn't change anything from what the current thing.
No, it's just current.
It's just whatever's in statute now, I suppose. So. You don't address that, then?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like to look at that. If they've had multiple offenses and they're killing people, I think they probably should give up that driver's license forever.
Representative.
Oh, Becky.
Curious, did you have.
Huh?
I can't hear.
Oh, you're looking at that book.
All right. I need a hearing aid. Anyway, why don't you go ahead with your testifier. You're on name and title.
Thank you for having us today. I'm Heather Bigler. I am the mother of Drake. He was killed. It'll be 3 years this summer. We were hit by a repeat offender. It was his third DWI, four times the legal limit. And because we're just here to try to help increase the laws so this doesn't happen to other families. Just it's tough because, you know, when somebody does something once, we understand people make mistakes, but when it happens a second and a third time, it's a choice. And so many times when you see the people that are way over the legal limit, they just make that selfish decision to keep doing what they're doing.
Yes, sir, your name?
Brad Bigler, Heather's husband and the father of Drake. I think one of the big steps, or one of the reasons why we're here too, is just to hold people accountable. We understand that it's probably not in those people's interests to kill someone. It's not what they're trying to do in that moment. But at the end of the day, when you have repeat offense and you are making decisions to put yourself in that situation, you have no fear. You have no concern or care for anyone else when you're putting yourself in that situation, especially doing it multiple times. And I think the first time we came up here, you know, we're emotional, and it really is about other people and protecting other people. And now we're up here a little bit, and my presence is a little bit more concerned. Concerned that this is a very, in the grand scheme of things, this is not a big change. Big movement. It's definitely a move in the right direction. But having gone through what we've gone through and know the person who killed our son, he's out right now. And he's literally out right now working. And to know that he will be out, and in July, when we're going back up to the cabin in July, there's a chance we can meet him on the road again. And that's very concerning. Again, I don't think it was his intention to hurt anyone that day. But he had no fear. And that's the problem right now with the with where we're at, is there is no awareness and no fear. And I don't know, again, this is just a small step, but it's a necessary step in our opinion. And we're here with just full of emotion. You know, when we have to come back to this and talk, when you have your heart, you have your anger, I mean, you kind of go through the full swing of emotions. And we just appreciate your time. And again, we just feel that it's a small step. It's an effort. In order to make change, in order to do something, make a difference, it takes effort. And this is a little effort. And I think this effort will go a long ways. Thank you.
Mr. Bigler, do you have other relatives in the room today?
We do. Go ahead.
You can go ahead and introduce them if you'd like.
My mom and dad, Bill and Robin Smith, and my sister, Sally, and our other three children, Talia Nash and Tatum.
We apologize for the noise, too. They were swimming last night pretty late, so they're a little out of routine.
And what was the name of your son, and how old?
Drake.
He was 5 months. His birthday was last Wednesday. He would have been three. So.
Well, very sorry for your loss, and thanks for being here today, all of you. So. Any questions from members? Representative, Ms. Perius, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, the revocation period for criminal vehicular homicide ranges from 6 years to 10 years, depending on the number of prior offenses.
Representative Considine?
Mr. Chair, I'm a little sketchy on some of the parliamentary procedures. I think they should lose their license for life, as they do in a lot of European countries after one DWI. But when you have multiple ones and you kill somebody, I don't think it's unreasonable that they would lose their license for the rest of their life. They have continued to endanger the public and have not shown a responsibility to the public at large. So is there a way that I can ask to have that included, or...
Yeah, we could. We're holding the bill over, so you could work on an amendment in the meantime, and we could do some research on it and see what the author and the Senate has got in their mind too, and look at the talk to Driver and Vehicle Services and see what the history is, if anybody's tried that before and how successful. So it sounds like an idea to me.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, this is more of a comment. In my years in law enforcement career, I've dealt with this issue many times. When I was talking to some of my law enforcement friends this morning at coffee, they had heard about this bill coming up. And I want to thank you for bringing this forward, because this is something that really needs to be done. In my home county, back in 2002, a gentleman that we dealt with numerous times was intoxicated, high on drugs, and hit a lady head on, killed her. They had a number of small children at the time. But as also, I've known her for many years. She's the sister-in-law of the sheriff that just retired from my county. That gentleman was convicted, put away, and this morning I looked up on the public court records. Since he's returned, he lost his limited license for violating it. He has numerous driving after revocation charges, and in fact, this past year he got picked up for DWI again. In the law enforcement community, we are tired of the revolving door dealing with some of these people time after time after time after time. And I believe we need something like this to start putting an end to that. And I want to thank you for bringing this forward.
Okay, thank you, Representative Johnson. We do have a fiscal note, and that's another reason, you know, to hold the over until we address that, as we have been doing in our other bills. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing the bill forward. Now I'm going to get emotional, too. Thank you for coming. I wonder if we need, perhaps not in this bill, but in some other way, to do something. I don't. Maybe it needs to go through Health and Human Services to talk about the fact that when people are addicted, it impacts their brain in such a way that, you're right, they don't care, they don't know, they don't fear any consequences. Their understanding of whatever the consequences are going to be far less. Their perception is that any consequence is far less than their need to satisfy that addiction. And that's about brain chemistry. So the other thing that I think about is our definition of level of consumption, blood alcohol levels. When people are addicted, they can be multiple times, I mean, you know, what I can manage in a drink, what my blood alcohol level would be, if I were at that level, I'd be dead. Because I don't have the tolerance. And they develop a tolerance for it. So maybe there needs to be something in terms of understanding that if there is an addiction, that level of blood alcohol can be very different and also impairs judgment. So I don't know where to go with that, and maybe that's part of something that we need to talk about with what's a legal limit and what isn't. For multiple times, if you've got an addiction, you're going to be able to handle a higher level. And that we need to have some other degrees of consequences or something that will get people off the roads. I'd like to talk with you more about it, too. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Representative Ward. For the author, or did you bring anybody along with you from DVS or DPS or anybody for technical questions? Or?
No, Mr. Chair, I did
not. Okay. I was just wondering about the, maybe Ms. Perius could answer this. Is this usually when you see on the amendment, A1 amendment, usually when you see this definition, it's usually substantial bodily harm or great bodily harm. This one says resulting in bodily harm. Is that lowering the standard to any bodily harm then? Or heightening to the enhancement, whatever way you look at it? Ms. Perius.
Mr. Chair, members, this amendment affects only one of the qualified prior driving offenses, and that's careless driving on line 1.21. And currently the language is modifying careless driving only involving damage to property, and this would say careless driving also resulting in bodily harm or death to another, and bodily harm would encompass bodily harm, substantial bodily harm, and great bodily harm.
Okay. Sounds good to me. Any questions from members?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Hills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very supportive of the proposal. I just want to make sure that we pay for whatever it really costs, and if that amendment has any impact on the that impact or the cost, we should maybe get an updated fiscal note between now and the end based on the amendments that were put on.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. And Representative Considine.
You have my condolences. And my brother was killed by a guy that blew through a stop sign in October.
Okay. Well, Representative Sudinski, any closing comments before we move your bill? And thank you very much, you testifiers, and appreciate you being here, the Bigglers.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a closing note, I just want to thank you again, committee members, for taking the time to hear this bill. And I think, you know, when we look into this issue, it's not only a very emotional issue, but we've all been touched by folks with addiction and folks that have made poor decisions. And, you know, this bill is a small bill, a small step, as Mr. Bigler said, in really trying to address the issues that we all face in our districts. I know Representative Rarick is sitting in the back of the room, who just had a young man, 17 years old, homecoming king, killed by a drunk driver. And you know, these are issues that we need to address as a society. And, you know, this isn't a be-all, end-all bill by any means. But, you know, how we address this in this legislature and the next, as elected representative, representing people that have problems and have people that have been affected by people's problems. And I hope to work with each and any one of you when it comes to maybe improving this bill or expanding this bill potentially. I just appreciate your time and appreciate your support. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Brzezinski. And House File 71, as amended, would be held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you. Next, we have the Guardian Ad Litem budget presentation. State Program Coordinator, rather than try to pronounce the name, and the Board Chair.
Good morning, Chairman Cornish, members of the committee. Are you ready for us to present our matter, Chairman? My name is Paul Nelson. I am a senior judge of district court and currently serve as chair of the Guardian Ad Litem Board. I had the opportunity to do our program overview before you in February, so I'm just going to be very brief in my opening comments. I have been board chair for slightly less than a year. Our program was moved out of the judicial branch in 2010, so we are a fairly new independent agency for the state, even though our roots go back quite a bit further. A couple of items. One of our board members wished to be here today. Sherry Haley is the Jackson County attorney and has prepared a letter which I believe will either be with the chair shortly or perhaps it's already arrived. I would just simply ask that, and I had spoken with Ms. Haley about a week ago, about her presence here before this committee to outline a person who has a little different perspective than some of the other board members as a longtime assistant county attorney and now a county attorney in southwest Minnesota who has had a longtime experience with guardians in child protection matters. As well as a tangential relationship with guardians in family court proceedings. So when that letter becomes available to you, and I know it will be disseminated to members of the committee, I would ask your attention to that because she makes some very good points as far as the program is concerned and as far as our budget request. With me here today is Suzanne Allegro, who is our program administrator, who will outline the budget points for our budget for request for the next biennium. We are willing to answer any questions that you may have, or at least make as good an attempt as we can to any questions after she concludes her presentation. So I turn it over to Ms. Allegro at this point.
Hey, Ms. Allegro, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As Judge Nelson indicated, I'm Suzanne Allegro, the Program Administrator for the State Gardening Ad Litem Board. The current biennial budget for the board is a little over $25 million. Of that, 90% is for personnel, and my next slide will show you what the personnel consists of. The other 10% is operating expenses. Included in the operating expenses would be things like mileage. Given that our guardians do need to make home visits, meet with relatives, teachers, that type of thing, it is a rather substantial part of the budget. In addition, we do have some contracts. We contract with State Court Administration for our IT and finance services. And additionally, a number of our guardians do have home offices, so home office stipends are included in the operating. I provided a chart that show our full-time equivalent positions by judicial district. And we right now have a total of 171.449 full-time equivalent positions, and this translates into 228 employees. What we obviously try and do within each judicial district is respond to the caseload needs of the district when we set up the staffing. This slide shows our current base for each of the fiscal years, 12.756, and our request for FY 16 is 14,953, and then for FY 17, 15,613. We basically, within that budget request, we have two change requests. And the first one is for $1 million each of the fiscal year to deal with a budget shortfall that we've been experiencing. And basically, since the board came into existence, we've experienced several issues that have led to the operating deficit. The first is when the program was under the court system, right before the program moved, they had the judges and court staff had studied the program, and they decided in order to have a more robust system and to deal with some of the issues with the guardian ad litems that they needed to no longer have independent contractors as guardian ad litems, but either employees or volunteers. So the decision was made to end the use of independent contractors. Even though some of the salaries, and this gets into another change request, when the independent contractors came over, they were making an hourly rate, that there are more expenses with an employee, such as insurance, FICA, that type of thing. So that added costs to the program. Additionally, there were costs established with setting up an independent agency. We have a small staff of five individuals at the central office, and as I had mentioned, we contract for our finance and IT services with State Court Administration. Starting in FY12, we did have a budget reduction of $300,000 each fiscal year. I would point out that in all of our, we are appointed only when there's a judicial order requesting our appointment. So all of the costs that have been associated are in response to the judicial orders for appointment. We have seen some increases. I mentioned the last time I was in front of the committee in some of the child protection cases. I think some of this we're feeling in some areas of the state. It's due to an increase in meth cases. Additionally, we may be seeing some of the effects of the governor's task force, where they're kind of looking at the issues of child protection. In some of our districts, we have had to put cases on a waiting list and have had to work with the judges in those districts.
Ms. Allegro?
Yes.
The shortfall has caused us some concern, is that it kind of looks like you made your own shortfall by the decision you made to move from the contractors to employee model. Did you think about holding off and making a request for the extra money to do that? Did you know it was going to cost you more when you went into it and cause you a shortfall? Or what went through your mind when you were processing that?
Mr. Chair, that decision was not made by the board. That was made prior to the board's coming into existence. And as I said, that was as a result of the study that the court system had done of the program. And Judge Nelson was on that study committee when it was under the court. So maybe you want to talk about that a little bit.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, during my tenure as chief judge in the 8th Judicial District, which is western Minnesota, I served as chair of the Guardian Ad Litem Advisory Committee. We met for a period of 18 months. I included stakeholders from all around, and we did a top-to-bottom analysis of the Guardian Ad Litem program at that time. There were issues that had preceded that task force. I was appointed by then Chief Justice Russell Anderson, dealing with issues relating to employee versus independent contractor models as far as legal issues were concerned. We did a detailed analysis of whether or not there were some concerns with calling these people independent contractors when in fact we had a significant amount of control over them. So one of the issues that we were asked to address was to look at some of those legal issues of independent versus employee. I think the recommendation of the task force was that it go to an employee model. However, there was also an issue with regard to the structure of the program, which happened at about the same time, and the decision was made to move it out of the judicial branch to avoid conflicts that were perceived because the judges were appointing and supervising, albeit indirectly, guardians who were parties. So when it moved out, the board made the decision to follow those recommendations to go to an employee model. And quite frankly, it costs more to have an employee model than an independent contractor, although some potential legal issues costs were something we were looking at the time. So it was, I don't believe it was a decision that was made lightly, but I believe it was a decision that was made correctly.
So in specific, what were the problems that were developing to make you go to the employee model? And it usually does cost more when you go to an employee model than private vendor, but the corrections is doing the same thing with their food program costing us millions because they decided to do that. But go ahead, sir.
Well, Chair, members, part of the issue, and we had an initial task force that I also chaired. We brought in outside counsel and did a detailed analysis. As you well know, there are IRS regulations as to what happens if an independent contractor is really an employee for all purposes. A guardian is someone we would have an independent contract with. However, because of the nature of the program, it certainly had to be supervised. They certainly had some obligations to meet. And there had been some issues with some unemployment claims and so forth. So we were, quite frankly, very concerned about the program being deemed to not be truly an independent contractor model.
Okay, Representative Ward, and then Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was the chief author of the bill that actually made them an independent board, and it was brought to me by the judiciary, Mr. Chair, because they believed that there was there really were some issues with their independence when they're making recommendations to the court. But for many, many years, this legislative body continued to cross-examine the Guardian Ad Litem program based on complaints that we were hearing, based on training and quality. And so it wasn't just a short-term fix. It had been a fix. I don't know. I think I've worked on it for 12 or 14 years, Mr. Chair. And so to get folks away from being volunteers or part-timers, not going through the training and making recommendations about what's going to happen with parents and children and whether or not they're going to stay in the home or not stay in the home, this legislature consistently said we needed to make it more professional. And so I'm very pleased that you've moved to this model finally, and I'm very supportive of funding it, Mr. Chair.
They must have done a lousy fiscal note then because they fell short of the money. All right. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much for your presentation. I guess Representative Considine.
We do have a couple other.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
We're not.
I almost cut you off.
I remain a little bit concerned about that professionalism. Now, I think last time I asked if a college degree was necessary, but that was just instituted in 2011. Prior to that, it wasn't. I believe that was the research I got. Is it fair to assume that there are guardian ad litems that were grandfathered in and continue to work with a high school degree?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that was there are probably a few around the state that were grandfathered in. I would say all the employees that we have hired since the board has come into existence do have a college degree, and other I believe you did, you know, we did send the information about the other qualifications as well. One other thing, Mr. Chair and Representative, part of the reason that we do, though, have in our volunteer pool that we do primarily use for child protection cases in Hennepin and Ramsey, we also have employee handling those cases, but we do have some volunteers that may not have a college degree but do have life experience or other experience that would be equivalent. But our employees do have college degrees.
Representative Costaway?
In the test, Mr. Chair, you also mentioned that meth was being was a contributing factor, that there were other contributing factors. Somebody that has a degree in history, and I believe it was the social sciences, any BA or BS in the social sciences would qualify. And I think that it's important enough work that maybe the professional standards should be raised a little bit. Somebody that's a social worker or somebody that's trained for this kind of work, rather than, like I said, what I got was that you could, any of the social sciences, you could have a, you could qualify as a guardian ad litem, and I don't know that I think they're necessarily qualified.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say most of our guardians, again, their degrees would be in fields like social work. We do have some attorneys. We do have some nurses, those people that have degrees in education. So typically, the educational background would be in one of those fields.
But not necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes,
Mr. Chair, members. One of the things that we always have to remember when we're talking about guardians is that they are the voice of and an advocate for the best interests of the child. And in child protection cases, you've got the county attorney's office, you've got the local family services agency, you've got the guardian who actually meets with the child. Now, clearly the guardian has available to him or her all of the information that's being provided across the board, and what they are doing is bringing the child's voice to that proceeding. My underlying degree before I went to law school was in biology, but I've spent a significant amount of time, 40 years now, expanding it, and I think these guardians have been exposed to a great deal in our training, and it continues to expand. Thank you.
Okay. Any more slides?
Yes.
Yeah, just a couple.
Just a couple more. And then our second change request has to do with employee compensation, and we had requested was $1,197,000 for FY16 and $1,857,000 for FY17. The compensation changes basically address two areas, pay parity and reduced turnover. The first part of the compensation request has to do with wage equalization. When I mentioned before that we moved from the independent contractor model to the employee model, we did have people apply for the positions, and given the budget constraints at the time, most of the people were brought in at the beginning of the salary range, which at this point, the beginning of our salary range for a guardian ad litem is $18.18. So the people were brought in regardless of how many years experience they had at the beginning of the salary range. What we would like to implement is a step system based on their years of guardian ad litem experience. So that amount is a little under $600,000 for each of the fiscal year. Additionally, the employees have not received merit or step increases since 2009, so we are requesting money to provide either step, merit, or across-the-board increases for each of the fiscal year. And then the third part of the request is for insurance increases for each year of the biennium.
Ms. Allegra, which method are you going to use? You said step or lanes, grids, merit pay, or all of the above?
Mr. Chair, for the our guardian ad litems are represented by the union, and so whatever the compensation package for the represented employees would be negotiated this coming summer. So we're putting money in anticipation, but we would be looking at whether we're looking at merit or step or across the board. That would be negotiated for the represented. For the unrepresented, we would be looking at a 5% increase each year.
Is it, Mr. Allegra, is it AFSCME or MAPE, or who would it be?
Mr. Chair, it's AFSCME.
Okay, members.
Oh, one.
Any on that? Okay, go ahead.
My last slide is that the governor did recommend full funding of the agency budget request.
Is that it?
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation. Any questions, members, before we let them go? Thank you much.
Thank you.
Now we have the Uniform Law Commission, a familiar face. You go ahead and state your. Do you have any graphics or just oral testimony?
Good morning.
Good morning, Chairman Cornish and members of the committee. Thank you very much for giving us time on your agenda this morning and for your support in maintaining the strength of the Minnesota delegation and the Uniform Law Commission. I'm Harriet Lansing. I'm a senior judge on the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and I am a Uniform Law Commissioner from Minnesota. I'm joined by Bob Tennyson, who is also a Uniform Law Commissioner from Minnesota. We discussed briefly the mission and the work of the Uniform Law Commission with the committee a couple of weeks ago. I would just say that we really believe that the work that the Uniform Law Commission is a vital part of our legislative fabric here in Minnesota, with 137 uniform acts being part of Minnesota law or having historically been introduced. We go from anatomical gifts to probate to business entities, commercial law, the Uniform Commercial Code, limited liability companies, to interstate family support, which we took up with you with this committee last year. We had five acts in the last biennium that were passed, and the acts that we're working on this year include the trust code, fiduciary access to digital assets, voidable transactions, formerly fraudulent transfers, many of us remembered it in that title, deployed parents, custody and visitation, amendments to the Uniform Limited Liability Company Act, correction and clarification of defamation, and the faithful elector. We believe that we are a relatively modest cost given the value that we bring to the states. Since 1892, this organization, which is made up of hundreds of thousands of lawyer hours that goes into these acts, is pro bono. We're uncompensated except for travel and expenses, and the dues that are required to fund our share of the operation. Minnesota's share of the overall budget for the ULC for fiscal year 2016 is $56,000 in dues, and for 2017 we project that it will be $57,000. The travel expenses for the annual meeting, which is a week-long session of reading every act proposed for adoption line by line, for the full Minnesota delegation, this brings the total to $87,000 for a total request for 2016 and $94,000 for 2017. So as I say, that's a total of $181,000 for the biennium. And I think that gives you an overview. I would ask Commissioner Tennyson if there's anything additional that he would like to say.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Tennyson. I'm a member of the Uniform Law Commission. And I think Harriet Lansing has summarized very well what we want to do. I want to also mention that Harriet is currently the president of the National Conference, has been for a year and a half. Minnesota has been very active in the conference. Several of us have served on the executive committee and other responsible committees. I currently serve on a drafting committee, which takes quite a bit of time, meetings and so on. I'm also chairing a new committee to look at the accuracy of criminal records across the country. The Minnesota delegation is involved in leadership of the national conference because we've been very active and in participating. And this, the conference is a very important part and contributes to the maintenance of our federal system. You know, the states have a responsibility in the federal system to make sure that they carry out duties and perform duties that can be done at the state level. For example, the Uniform Commercial Code obviously could be a federal action. It governs the commerce in this country, its contracts and so on, are interstate. But because we maintain a strong position in that area, update the laws periodically and so on, but we assist in maintaining the integrity of the federal system. So I think we serve that purpose. We help the legislature. The legislatures scrutinize all our work. Our acts are take years to develop. We're not slow, but we're pretty thorough. I mean, we're not fast, but we're pretty thorough. We may be slow too. I don't know. Our acts are generated by suggestions from many places and many people, many organizations. We work closely with the American Bar Association, and our committee meetings are all open. Anybody who has an interest in our committees is invited to participate in the drafting process. We get information from that inform us of how to draft an act based on the input of people from around the country. So it's a very open process, very thorough process. And as Harry Lansing said, these bills are read, drafts are read line by line at annual meetings. And if you sat in the legislature and read every bill line by line and debated it, it might take a little longer than you do now, but that's what we do. And after the first reading at an annual meeting, the committee goes back and licks its wounds, considers all the comments, revises it accordingly, and it's brought back for another line-by-line reading at a subsequent annual meeting. So it's very thorough, very well vetted. It's questioned by a couple hundred people in the audience and saying, well, you haven't thought of this, or you haven't thought of this, and how does this work? It doesn't mean we don't make mistakes, but that's the background. And as a lawyer, it's fun to do, actually. That's why we do it. So I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Tennyson, what specifically are you allowed to spend dues and travel costs on? What categories would qualify?
We get reimbursed for our airfare and the hotel. The registration fees for our going to the annual meeting, and a per diem of $35 or $45 a day, whatever it is. That's it.
So it's not just mileage. There's other things that go in there.
I'm sorry.
It's not just mileage. There's a lot of other things that could qualify.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the three things. The hotel bill, which is a convention rate. We have a registration fee, and our we get the fourth thing, per diem, which is $35 for food for or 45 whatever it is, and then our airfare.
Okay.
And it's, that's it.
Okay, ma'am, are you any more for your presentation?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would just add to that that all of the drafting committee work that we do, which is a number of weekends during the course of the year on all of these acts, we currently have 19 drafting committees and 7 study committees. And the commission itself, with the dues, pays for the drafting committees, and then we also try to augment our income through intellectual property licensing and in any way that we can. In fact, I got talked into being president of this organization by my delegation because that means that I do not have to pay for a hotel, my hotel charges for the annual meeting. So we try to be very frugal about how we're using the money, and I just wanted you to also know that.
Mr. Tennyson, how long you been with the outfit?
Mr. How long been a commissioner? I put in 1989.
1989? Yeah, yeah, I thought I saw you here when I was a lobbyist. Even, so.
Yeah. No. Well, Mr. Chairman, many of you have seen me around as in the last several years, but I did retire from my active practice of law at the end of last year, so I'm not here anymore as a lobbyist for anybody.
All right. Well, thank you for being here today. Members, any questions? Thank you very much for your presentation. I think if we fund you, it's not going to break the bank, it looks like.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your time.
Anybody have anything? Adjourned to Del Mar.